This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 97, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted today to be joined today by Nigel Verdon, CEO and co-founder of Rails Bank, to discuss whether open banking will turn out to be a white elephant. This is the kind of topic suggestion I normally fend off with a very large barge pole I keep handy at LFP Towers for this very purpose. Plenty of folks email me wishing to be on and give their views and opinions. However, Nigel is no mere fintecher with his own opinion. Way back in LFP 024, Nigel shared his 25 years' experience in fintech and hardcore fintech at that, from doing the first internet FX deal in 1992 through running digital markets at Dresdner Kleinwort's to founding Uber Fintech, Currency Cloud. Since when he's VC'd and now for some time being CEO and founder of Rails Bank, whose strapline is giving business access to global banking with five lines of code. I wonder what those lines of code are. They must be good lines. Anyway, we will talk about Rails Bank, what it is and where it's going later in the show. But for now, no need of much preamble, as you will all have heard plenty and perhaps too much about open banking. LFP 060, an overview with Paul Tamala at ACI Worldwide, is still number two in the all-time download charts. And as recently as LFP 087, Louise Beaumont argued passionately that it's not really about tech and rec, but far more about strategy. So, as we enter 2018, the year of open banking, an appropriate 50 years after 1968, which is perhaps the high watermark of open bonking, who better to talk about the question of is the future a palace of marble and ivory, or sackcloth and ashes? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Nigel. Thanks for joining me again today.
Thanks, Mike. It's always a pleasure.
And in terms of the pleasure, I should say, just to paint a picture in the listener's ears, that this is a rather more intimate pleasure than last time, and partly because we've taken some of our clothes off, which actually relates to the fact that we've now set a record for the smallest broom cupboard in which I've ever recorded a podcast. So I'm worried that actually behind all the echoes, no one will actually understand a thing. And for those people who are old enough to remember the UK telephone box, we're in a space which is roughly twice that. So clearly Rails Bank aren't wasting too much money on meeting rooms. Or maybe it's just podcasters. Maybe when you have important things come in, you have a larger room. So I was saying that one of the many, many things you've done in the past was foreign exchange. And last week's podcast was with David Mercer. And when I spoke to David, I asked him for something interesting, and he said he played the most northerly game of rugby ever on the North Pole. And I was wondering whether you've done anything comparable, but actually you chose the other direction to talk about, i.e. not sort of desert and white, but lots of stuff around you recently.
Yes, just recently I was with family over in Costa Rica for taking some time off after Christmas. It's quite an amazing experience of being in the jungle. I've been in the jungle in Malaysia before. This is the first time in the rainforest and the cloud forest. And just the raw experience of the ecosystems there were fascinating. There's also another thing, because I didn't do my reading on Costa Rica before going there. The country hasn't had an army since 1942.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
No army at all. And you'd think it'd be a bit sort of laid back and manuana. The country runs like clockwork. It's like, it's known as the Switzerland of Central America. And it's a very, sort of very friendly, happy country. And it's a real surprise.
Did they take lots of drugs or something?
There didn't seem to be that issue there either. There's just a general happiness. It's almost like Bhutan taken out the Himalayas and stuck in Central America.
Well, that's certainly an interesting idea of crossing Bhutan and Switzerland and put it in Central America. And it sounds like I should think about doing a special Costa Rican episode of the London FinTech Podcast, sponsored by Rails Bank, which we can talk about later, because that does sound very colourful.
It does remind me of, I think there's a classic quote from the finance minister of Bhutan, said, "We can't compete with the world on gross domestic product, but we're world leaders on gross domestic happiness."
Yes, I remember being interested in this sort of idea myself, and even David Cameron flirted with it when he was sort of newly elected the first time round. But then it got a bit sort of civil service-ized, so they started sort of coming up with ways to measure people's happiness. You know, I don't know, how many cylinders in your car and how many square metres in your house and what your salary was and how many days off. And da-da-da-da-da, which is a bit like dissecting a butterfly. You find out more and more about the butterfly, but by the time you finish, the butterfly is utterly dead.
And yes, no more butterfly.
Yes, indeed. And in terms of the blind leading the blind, I'm not sure you know the answer to this, because I thought I did, but I was told off and Bridget and I were in Thailand in what I said was a rainforest. And anyway, she with her A-level geography said, no, this isn't rainforest, on some technical thing I couldn't quite remember. But to me, it was very foresty. It's certainly very rainy there, and it was in the tropics. So I kind of assumed that was rainforest, actually.
I think it's defined by the ecosystem and the type of plants and the type of animals, vegetation, because there's a difference in cloud forest.
Yeah.
And rainforest, apart from the cloud forest being generally cloudy and the rainforest being generally wet and defined by height. But you see different types of vegetation, animals, etc. in the cloud forest and in the rainforest, which I presume there's another one, which is the jungle, which is another definition as well. Something of height and also the different types of vegetation and everything you get in those different strata, as you might say.
Oh, that does sound like sort of rather educated perspective. I didn't take that not being as educated as you. I took the sort of, you know, the sort of defensive relationship. Well, I think it's rainforest. And trying to sort of bat it away. But actually talking different strata of forests and these places abroad. Following on, we went to Singapore, where last time I was there, there weren't the Marina Bay Gardens, where they've got these two huge enclosures, one of which is so vertical and it's got this sort of falling rain that it simulates the cloud forest at the top of it. And then you walk down a spiral and you come through a sort of, you know, a tropical bit and a temperate zone and all that. Right, OK, so back to sitting in a very small TARDIS near Angel.
Well, by definition, a TARDIS isn't small.
Yes. Yes. Well, I don't think this TARDIS works, mate.
Exactly.
I think you've been sold a bit of a pup here. This is what the TARDIS looks like before it actually sort of works. So, talking about being sold a pup, you were just saying before we kicked off, I was saying that my trouble with open banking is that I long ago sort of fell asleep when I saw anything on LinkedIn or anything else about open banking. And going back to the Buddha's phrase about views and opinions, or Dirty Harry. Dirty Harry said, opinions like arseholes, everyone's got one. But I don't think that's actually true unless people have got a million arseholes, because people have got loads and loads of opinions. We are now in the world of open banking, and I did, out of the kindness of my heart and respect for your sort of age and wisdom and all this kind of stuff, say I'll let you off the lead on it. But before we just dive into the open banking bit of it, for those sort of ignoramuses, or whatever it is, such as myself, can you just give us a little refresher on the sort of spirit of the UK's open banking, as it were, versus the European PSD2, which are a bit like two Venn diagram circles, they kind of overlap somewhat?
Well, PSD2 is a lovely read, if you choose to read it. I haven't. And it's really about legislation across Europe, including UK, because UK is still in Europe. That defines payment services, the open banking piece, and a whole load of other legislation that was not there in PSD1 and was fixed in PSD2. So if you're a complete regulation geek, you love regulation, you love reading this sort of stuff, it is very interesting. But fundamental, the one piece that is drawn out of that, which is just a section of it, is this whole open banking, which is across Europe, the legislation. There's the UK founded openbanking.org.uk to help pioneer it in the UK. So open banking itself is just part of legislation. It's got two lovely acronyms called PSIP and ASIP. And I can't remember them off the top of my head, but one says, I'm able to initiate payments and give permission to initiate payments from my bank to you. And another one is, I give permission for you to look at my data that is held in my bank. And a bank has to let third parties access your data or initiate a payment on your behalf.
Right. Okay. So that's clear and helpful. And I mean, without getting into the detail, the spirit in both Europe and the UK, because of course the UK was in particular looking at the European bigger context, certainly when it started this journey, as everyone will have heard a million times, is that actually it is now no longer the bank's data on you, or for that matter, Amazon, although we're not talking about that business, Amazon's data on you or Twitter's data on you, it is your data.
Yes.
So we all know that. And the spirit of the open banking, without even getting to the complexities you mentioned about push, pull and peer or whatever, peep, is that we can share the data. And again, I think we will have all seen stuff, which is that this is going to absolutely change the world. We will have seen stuff around the fact that what it was, half a dozen banks can't quite get their act together and it's going to take them another year and da-da-da-da-da. So, well, let's just start with hype.
Can I take a step back to why this has been really put in place? I think banking is one of the few products, especially current accounts, where if you ask somebody, do you like your bank, they're likely to say, not really. would you like to move? Of course. Then will you move? No, because the other bank has exactly the same product and I get the same service. So there is actually no differentiation between any bank's current account. All of it is pretty bad service. There's one of the few products in the world where people, if they're incentivized to change, just won't change because it's more of the same. So that means there's also no competition in that area. So part of the spirit of open banking was the government's trying to work out how can we engender and empower the individual and the industry to open up more competition between things and innovation. And could innovation drive the competition, and could access to data and making payments drive innovation to for the benefit of the consumer and make a more interesting market so people will switch?
Absolutely. And so that's why it was started by the CMA, the Competition Markets Authority. Yes. So it was driven by that perspective, very similar to the Payment Systems Regulator, this odd kind of very rare approach in financial regulation, which is actually trying to increase competition.
Yes.
Rather than here's a billion rules, follow them or you're in the nick.
Yeah. So that was sort of backdrop. So which I found fascinating, all this hype, lots of people talk about open banking and it's the typical sort of high school sex. So we talked about it, not many people actually really know what it's really about or experienced it. So it's all about APIs, application programming interfaces, where you use technology and you write code to access your banking and stuff. The fundamental thing is my grandmother doesn't write code. Very few consumers write code. There's developers and stuff like that, but you don't go to your bank and say, I'm going to write a bit of Perl or some Java or write some Clojure to access my banking because that's what I do to use my banking. I use my app, telephone, visit the branch. That's your experience of banking. So this whole open banking thing, when was it, January the 13th, was a bit of a sort of letdown because there's a pure industry-only, navel-gazing announcement. It's here. For consumers, who cares?
I think the only thing was the latest piece of crap I got from my bank, so I've changed your terms and conditions, sir, which I just immediately sort of chucked straight in the bin, apparently was about open banking.
And there was a whole of media articles about it hasn't been communicated properly and all this type of thing. Well, hey, it's changed your T's and C's, so you're going to have to be able to do this. So what's happened is the industry infrastructure has been changed. And that what January the 13th was all about. And changing the industry infrastructure and giving access, open access to your data and to make payments on your behalf is now enabling third parties like fintech companies and other non-fintech companies, people just know data aggregators, to do interesting things and innovate, very much like when the App Store was launched by Apple. You got a load of APIs, you can then go and innovate and create stuff. So we at the complete sort of cusp of what is going to happen. And this is a 2 to 3 year process of when we're going to see the real benefit for the consumer. So I don't think anything really is going to happen next couple of months. Perhaps by the end of the year, there'll be some more interesting products out there that use this new PSD2 and open banking APIs to do interesting stuff for consumers. At the moment, it's a total navel-gazing thing. And I think the media, I'll throw out a challenge to the media. This isn't communicated to consumers. So people read an article and it doesn't pass what I call the SFW test. It's a G.
That was a song by the Anti-Nowhere League, actually, yes, which I definitely recommend you check out on YouTube. It's a very unique approach to do with sheep and goats.
So it's something that's is great for the industry. Was it going to be great for the consumer? We actually don't know yet.
I'm just pressing pause there. So I did read an article with the chief commercial officer of Metro Bank, who are one of the more successful UK challenger banks of recent years and the only high street one. And I'm not sure he was saying this, but what occurred to me reading that was that, of course, fintechs need to raise enthusiasm in the first place, and then they need to raise money from VCs and, you know, that place for PR and yada, yada, yada. So it's one of these examples where, for some time, a prospective change in the future is it's going to change the world. And funny enough, the people who are saying it's going to change the world have got a vested interest, because if they say, do you know what, it might change it a little bit in 5 years' time, they won't actually raise enthusiasm in potential angels or VCs, and they won't get any money. So anybody who said that, and who knows what's right, but anyway, anyone who said that just died at birth. And then vice versa, if you're sort of VCs or angels and you've bunged a few quid or more than a few quid into a company and there's PR going around and all that kind of stuff, well, of course, that's going to say, my God, the world is going to change beyond all recognition going forwards. So almost by definition, it's the first part of the hype cycle. I think what the chap from Metro Bank was speculating, and he would have an angle as well himself, of course, is that actually it'll take so long, i.e. 3 to 5 years, before we get anything, and maybe we don't get anything that dramatic at that point, that by then all these sort of new appy-only so-called challengers will probably have sort of run out of cash and not really done very much. So he was kind of presenting this race against time for the newbies versus the incumbents.
That's an interesting perspective, to be honest. There is, if you look a few years back, he has a point. If you looked, there was a company called Intelligent Finance.
I have my bank account with Intelligent Finance, who, as a result of a government initiative, nagging me crap rates, and I can't be bothered to change it. They were, for people abroad, I think the first online bank account set up by this special, clevery, and this is 20 years ago.
Yeah, and there was a thing called Egg at the time. There was a thing called Smile. And there was all these card-led banks, which don't exist anymore.
Well, Intelligent Finance is still there.
Is it?
It's part of Lloyds. And because the government said to Lloyds, they shall diversify, Lloyds said, sorry, customers, we're going to screw you over on the rates, please go. But getting back to my perspective on current accounts, which is that all the research I've shown, which is that you ask people the top 4,237 problems, current accounts don't make it there. I mean, something isn't in mine. I mean, there's lots of wishes I'd ask my fairy godmother before that.
And the only one that came out of it that is still here is First Direct.
Yes.
That's the only product there, and that was just a branch of HSBC at the time.
Yes.
We're sort of seeing the same again.
Yeah, so basically the point you're making, again for these people who are either too young or too far abroad, is that for the sake of argument, digital, in the simplest sense of digital, digital banking, online banking has been here 20 years.
Yes.
Used by people like me.
Now, the user experience of it has changed and has much better user experiences, but that's the only real innovation in it. It's still banking. And there isn't a real innovation taking it forward. In terms of now PSD2 and giving access to people to build interesting stuff to change your financial life and all this hype that's been going on, I think there is going to be, I disagree, it's going to take 3 to 5 years, 2 to 3 possibly. And it's the same moment as when Apple released the iPhone. We were given APIs with an accelerometer, data, voice, music, and all those things. And people came up and wrote apps that we'd never thought existed. So I think when that moment in time, the innovation starting. Now, we're going to get a lot of Me Toos. We're going to get a lot of, what was that? That was makes no sense. Well, we're also going to get some innovation using these two fundamental things, a data API and a payment API, to do interesting stuff for consumers. So that's where we are now. As I said, my grandmother doesn't write code, so it's not going to help consumers now. But over the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to see, I think, a real change in this industry.
And have you seen anything that you found particularly interesting? Because so far, in terms of potential applications, a lot of them that kind of have some credibility suffer from being a bit on the teenage side. I mean, there's a lot of sort of budgeting apps or something like that, you know, sharing the cost of pizzas and all that kind of sort of focus, which is fine, but it's a very narrow demographic. You know, the average current account holder in the UK doesn't really fuss around sharing the price of a pizza.
Yeah.
You know, whatever social demographic they're in, whatever income band they're in. So, you know, the budgeting app is obviously one, but there again, you know, these have been around in sort of current accounty things for some time, and it's not a big deal having pots of money like Monzo are doing. I mean, it's helpful, but it's not radical.
It's not radical, but they've increased accessibility. They had to be in a desktop and they weren't particularly usable. Now, because of it's mainly this mobile's driven the change, being on the device and making it simple and easy, and you're able to have a clear visualization, that is a bit of an innovation. It's not a huge innovation, but it gives more accessibility. And then if you've got accessibility, you've got usage. Yeah. On a desktop, you didn't go and go, oh God, I've got to go into my bank again. So that is something that is helpful. In terms of the demographics, like everything, if you played a long-term game, target them when they're at university or young kids, you'll bank them for life because people don't switch bank accounts. So if the switching still is, you may switch between people because the underlying banking account becomes a utility, that is a possibility. But the app owner, who isn't the bank, still owns the customer. So one of the things that if you roll this forward a couple of years, does the current account become a utility product that actually comes out of all the banks and there's a central government current account utility that everybody sits on top of? That may be a bit too dangerous, but that sort of concept, part of the bank becomes a utility now. So if you roll this another bit forward, now the real game, and this is where PSD2 APIs are going to be used, I believe, is opening up who is your daily per minute every second point of accessing the internet or accessing stuff. And we've all seen it in our kids, we've all seen it ourselves. WhatsApp, WeChat, Facebook Messenger, all these different mechanisms, that's your day-to-day interface to stuff. And because chat and conversation is natural, filling in forms is not natural. Computers tell us to do that because it's the only way to interact with a computer. So if the conversation now, which is a chat-type interface, is how we're going to interact with the world, that is where the bank will be interacted with. So because you've now got APIs, the chat world can interact with bank to get your data, make payments and that type of thing. So the bank does get marginalized. I think some of the neobanks and the new apps will get marginalized because they're not your day-to-day. And if your chat becomes the interaction point, one of the areas is, if you're looking at it as a bank, how can I compete to be the best utility to attract the current account and the deposits, etc., of the individual? So that's where I think it'll roll out, the bank become utility, and the conversation and the whatever top of your mind on your phone is going to be the interaction point with the customer. Now, a lot of the banks are absolutely terrified of this because they lose the customer. I think they should be a bit braver, to be honest, because if they lose the customer, and current accounts, they all lose money on anyway, what they need to do is profile the ones when they want the customer back and start selling product and helping them access product that will get them to be the customer they want rather than the customer they don't want.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a number of points in that. I mean, one I'd like to take off is that since we were last talking, whenever it was 2 or 3 years ago, one of the things that I've observed, and I know you're extremely well plugged in yourself, is that compared to, say, 3 years ago, the best incumbents have really started to get their shit together, hire some good people and spend some good money. Even if it takes them 10 times as much money as it does a startup or 100 times, they've got it. And they still have a huge market share. I think I went to some talk by the Barclays CEO, New City Agenda, and you know, he waved his phone. He said, look, you know, we've got over 6 million app users already. So, you know, and we're not that stupid. We can't sort of, you know, we sit there and look at what the other app people are doing and we implement it as well. So I think the competition is a bit more level. And then I think coming back to this thing that I was always a big skeptic about, this problem in competition in current accounts, which is that if you stay in credit, which most people do, it's free. So I'm not worried about the fact that intelligent finance or whatever is that thing. And as I mentioned somewhat sarcastically in the New Year special, I was rather critical of Monzo's tech last year, which was having sold customers on a pink card and benefits X and Y. Then we start getting messages, oh, X is costing us money and oh, Y is costing us money and all that kind of stuff, you know. And this is one of the challenges, of course, with the new challenger banks as a whole or specifically the app banks, which is that they're doing a bunch of stuff. In terms of how hard can it be, harder than you think. Revolut's perhaps a bit further forward in terms of having lots of things there and customers and partners and all that. But whether it's the 3 to 5 years of the Metrobank chap or whether it's your 2 to 3 years, these folks, they've got to hang around a little bit, and they also all need to transition to being this old-fashioned thing called a business, don't they, which has got revenue as well as costs, and hopefully the revenue is higher than the costs, and then they can play the longer game.
Yeah, I agree. It's a bit of a land grab in that market and working out how do you actually make money out of those customers. Because for me to switch from app A to app B, it's fine.
It's easy. Yeah, it's now frictionless.
It's now frictionless. So the sign-up process, we do it ourselves because like my co-founder, Clive, we work a lot with businesses or card-based businesses. And we have, I think he's got about 15 cards.
Oh, you need to fund yourself somewhere.
Okay. Taking the friction out also allows competition to do that too. So will the app be just as undifferentiated as the current account itself?
Absolutely, this is my point. So I hear where you're going with the commodity stuff and account, but frankly, so can the budgeting software.
Yeah, budgeting software, yeah. Again, budgeting software, if it's there and available to you and useful, that is your probably interface to your bank. So it's like, how do I look after my money rather than how do I bank is a more useful thing. And if you look at what human beings do, they may be worried about their finances. Are they going to get enough money before the end of the month? Can they afford this? And those type of questions, which banking apps don't tell you.
Yeah.
And whether you call it budgeting or financial health or whatever the marketing guys are coming up with, that is much more useful to the person. So in terms of the access to banking on its head, because of PSD2, you don't have to have a banking app to access banking. You can have something that helps your financial life, and then the banking gets done in the background.
Yes, absolutely. Well, which will lead us nicely into Realms Bank in a minute. I mean, my feeling on this, again, going back to the early days of the App Store or even the .com stuff, you know, I bought books from this place called Amazon and they sold books and I knew what Amazon did kind of stuff. I had no idea that 20 years later I'd buy all my Christmas shopping on there.
Or your vegetables.
No, I don't buy vegetables, I guess. But my feeling is that some radical stuff will emerge, but the radical stuff is not something I personally I've heard about yet. Nothing no. I've heard about has got I've got that excited by. And by radical stuff, Trussell won a little while ago. I liked what Trussell do. You didn't have to be a Trussell customer. You stick your mortgage on there and it monitors the rates and you know, pings you a little email or whatever and says, oh, Mr. Verdon, your £1 billion mortgage, you know, you're now paying 10% more than someone else. And, you know, press a button. Or an example I always use, I mean, if it's out there, please let me know someone, which is that if there was a sort of an open data around electricity and gas and water suppliers in the UK, I'd very happily give, let's say Rails Bank did this, or you form a new startup by the time you're on the show next doing energy, because it's much easier than banking. I sign up with your app, and your app monitors the best prices day to day and switches automatically. I go, oh, wow, now that is cool.
You switch as partway there.
yeah, absolutely. No, but I mean, this is my point about something that's radical, something that truly does something that is pretty inconceivable today.
Yeah.
You know, and going back to bank accounts and all that stuff and the early days, I mean, I remember in the 80s when I started to have a little bit of sort of surplus income, I'd stick it in a building society, which meant popping out at Clarmorts at lunchtime and going around the corner to Abbey National or something. And, oh, wow, it's a great rate. I get really excited about it. And then forget about it for a while. And then 3 months later, I'm walking past, hang on, what's happened to that rate somewhere else? You know, so the problem of getting the best rates around the place has always been there. And you're right about U-Switch and money comparison sites, but they've got their own challenges now and going back to the Competition and Markets Authority. So one thing that you had some interesting thoughts on, Nigel, which I think would be good to share, were the unintended consequences.
Sure. One of the things that open banking will give access to is you can allow people to access your banking and credit card and other data. So why is that useful? When you're lending money to people, you want to see what their financial behaviours are. Some of the data that you use to define financial behaviours is your bank account and what comes in, what goes out, what you spend it on, etc. And so sharing that should be able to give you, if you behave well, better rates for borrowing, if you want to borrow. And the same way in the insurance world is, I think Aviva have that thing you stick in your car. If you drive well, your premiums go down.
Don't have one of them. My premiums would go up.
Okay. So I was thinking through of a couple of colleagues over a few glasses of wine saying, actually, there could be real unintended consequences of this. Because if you don't have the data on you, are you going to get persecuted? And so...
But in what context do you mean persecuted?
As in, because there's no data, therefore you're high risk, ergo go collect data and what used to be called a credit score.
Guilty until proven innocent, which seems to be the model.
Absolutely, yes. Say refugee turns up.
Yep.
And there's no data on them. They're a qualified doctor. They're getting employed as doctors. There are a whole lot of data points around them, which you're not going to know at that point in time. And they desperately need to borrow some money to do X, Y, and Z. They're going to be persecuted because they don't have data. So is there going to be a world of data haves and data have-nots? And is there going to be a world of arbitraging of data, where you manipulate your data to essentially arbitrage the risk scoring to get low rates as well? So it was just, there may be things you, as a society, just be conscious that not only do we exclude people from banking, we exclude people and we push them into the payday lenders again because they haven't got data to be able to get better rates even though they're a good person. So it can create a sort of split cyber society. And if you look in the UK, just the UK alone, there's 8 million unbanked people who are perfectly good people, but banks won't bank them because they don't make a profit out of them, and they haven't got enough data on them, or they've just arrived in country, or they're an expat. And because you haven't got your residency side of things, or you're renting, it's almost impossible to get a bank account. In Europe alone, there's 82 million unbanked. And that's just in Western Europe. World, it's a 2 billion person issue. So we've just got to be very conscious, I think, especially at a governmental level and regulation level, of creating a two-tiered society.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I buy that. And I was remembering being at a New City Agenda talking about it, where they'd all done various sort of research reports and all this kind of stuff. And they were all kind of disagreeing with each other, blah, blah, blah. But actually, three of them agreed on, you know, this will mean that consumers can get better deals. Now, there's a whole interesting line, actually, in passing recently about how societies have changed as a result of everyone being viewed as a consumer, not a citizen. But that's a whole podcast in itself, actually. When you're just a consumer, you have no rights. Your job is to go and buy shit, yeah. You know, or make it for other people. When you're a citizen, you've got rights and all that, putting that one aside. Anyway, one lady at the end said, well, yes, but if some people are getting a good deal, then some people aren't. So the older people who don't use computers, that, you know, so this is unfair. So, you know, it needs to be stopped. So the digital haves and have-nots applies across the spectrum. I'm never in favour of genderism or ageism or any of these isms whatsoever, but I don't like this idea that sort of millennials do this, that and the other. I met plenty of millennials that don't have the wisdom to listen to podcasts, and I do. And equally, I think my dad spends more time online than I do, because if you're an old folk, once you know, you had read about it today called the disease span. You've got your lifespan, you've got your health span and disease span. And, you know, anybody with relatives in their 80s will know the one about sort of a dozen drugs and from the doctors and constantly sort of seeing the doctor and all that kind of stuff. So they've got plenty of time. So actually, this idea that sort of, you know, old folks are sort of digitally dumb is kind of the opposite. They're just a bit slower to learn, as am I, but actually they can spend quite a lot on time. But anyway, the point in terms of the digital haves and have-nots applies in multiple dimensions, not just the data. It's kind of, do you have a phone? Well, not everybody has a smartphone. You say there's 8 million unbanked. I mean, I don't know how many people don't have smartphones. My mum doesn't.
My 82-year-old father has now.
Oh, you see. Oh, that's where you got the genes from.
So, no, we gave it to him because...
Did he work it?
No, he worked it fine. We gave it to him because he has his email, and his granddaughters, my two daughters, kids don't use email anymore.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Occasionally I have to email mine because they're at university. They never bloody reply.
No, so email is probably of the past now. They all use WhatsApp.
I mean, mine won't even use text unless I'm very lucky.
So to be able to communicate to granddaughters and keep in touch with them and stuff, because email, they just didn't reply. WhatsApp, they're always able to reply to their grandfather. So he likes it because he can keep in touch with the granddaughters, which is a bizarre thing of this whole digital infrastructure. And I remember my day, we all used to write these things called letters.
Yes.
And I'd telephone my parents, okay, about every 3 months.
Yes. Yes. No, I do have to remember that when I get sort of frustrated that I pinged one of my daughters about something important and they haven't replied in a couple of days, that I used to remember the time I thought, oh, God, I've got to call my parents next week. And I'm going to stand by the phone box and stick money in and, yes, and all that kind of thing. So that's called karma, I think, what goes around comes around. So, okay, we've touched a number of things. I like these unintended consequences, which certainly haven't been picked up by the press and money talks in terms of PR and all that, and hopefully we've given people some things to think about. And before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there and my brand partners for the podcast. Blue Motor Finance combine extensive experience with a fresh and innovative approach. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over £500 million of lending to over 50,000 customers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. And as I said last week, and I'll say for a couple of weeks, they're both recruiting heavily at the moment. So if you're bored of your professional life or any other part of your life for that matter, why don't you check them out? In the meantime, they sent me some propaganda when I asked for one sentence. I think they both sent me two, which is that Blue Motor Finance got the best fintech lender last year. They're looking for enthusiastic, committed and innovative people. That rules me out. In both operational, technical and sales roles, that's not good English. Anyway, in all those. And Will at Smart Pension was telling me that they were the overall winner of the Digital Leaders Awards last year, which goes beyond fintech, and they beat Monzo to the prize. And they have many very interesting but challenging tech roles. So check them out, folks, if you want to do something new. So, Nigel, thank you for the open banking. I'm very grateful to you because you've now saved me from having to think about it for the next year, as we will see what actually happens about it. In terms of Rails Bank, it hasn't cropped up much en passant. So would you just like to tell us what these five lines of code are, or perhaps not so much what the five lines are, but what they enable people to do, if not your grandmother, to do the five lines of code, and what Rails Bank is up to, where it's going, and all that kind of stuff, and who should check you out?
Sure. Rails Bank, now my grandmother wouldn't interact with Rails Bank. I'll tell you why we built Rails Bank, and it'll perhaps answer what is Rails Bank. HSBC, Citibank, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan all have a global transaction banking product, which means you can open bank accounts in each country, receive money, send money, issue cards, collect money, direct debits, all those wholesale financial products that businesses use. But when you want to access those with your own building a new app or integrating with your accounts receivable, accounts payable, it's very difficult to do and very costly. So we decided to build that, and we said, let's go and build a new global digitally first transaction bank, which is a wholesaler. So we don't go near consumers.
So you're B2B.
B2B only. So we looked at HSBC and realized HSBC, for example, is 50 legal entities with one logo on top. So we turned that slightly on its head.
There are 50 logos, you mean?
No, 50 legal entities.
No, I know, but you turned it on its head, which means you have 50 logos. You see, I'm paying attention.
Okay. We have one logo at the moment. Probably 50 versions of it, but one logo. So we thought, instead of us being the bank, let's work with 30 banks around the world, each of them a local bank in each country, put our technology and Wells Bank's platform and compliance and banking platform on top, and our logo, and then we can deliver to the customer who wants a digitally first transaction banking product, which is like open accounts in seconds, send and receive money all the way around the world, issue cards, convert money, collect money through direct debit. And if they could do that and open up with us in under 5 days, that would be an insanely great product to have.
Well, that would be phenomenal. And going back in the day a few years ago, Hiroki from Go Cardless was on. I was saying to him, how long would it take you if you wandered out there and told your chums, let's do Canada? Would it be by the end of the week or the end of next week? And he said, well, more than about 6 or 9 months.
We told the same. We used Go Cardless as one of our partners on Wells Bank because we hooked together banks. They give us access to the country. And then best of breed products like Air Wallets for foreign exchange and payments, Go Cardless for collecting money, because they've solved the use cases, they've solved the infrastructure, and have made a really nice API that we can hook into. So we take financial Lego, assemble it together, and then we just give one common API.
You're a one-stop shop. So yes. For example, were I to invert my business model entirely, remain with the one logo, and pay my brand partners, this is going to be a very strange model, pay my brand partners and take money off the listeners around the world in 170 countries. Well, actually, you don't do 170, but it's a start with my 30 favourite countries. Then presumably I could plug into you, could I? And
correct.
Then suddenly I've got bank accounts all over, and somehow I tell my 10 million listeners what the bank account details are, and they pay me sort of a thousandth of a cent for every episode or whatever.
Absolutely, yes. That's the fundamental behind Wells Bank, is to build a global bank that works in the world of instant, because we're used to Amazon, we can buy things instantly. We're used to Twitter, we can buy things instantly. Go to my bank, and it takes months to open an account for business if they'll bank you. So we wanted to change banking accessibility into the world of instant.
And you mentioned compliance, and we don't have time to go into that in great detail, but at a very simple level, one of your challenges going to open a bank account, for example, in Costa Rica, will be proving who you are, you know, KYC, yep. AML, and yada, yada, yada. So the London FinTech Podcast Limited wants to open 30 bank accounts around the world. How come I don't have to, again, you know, put my thumbprint on 30 documents around the world and sign it and prove who I am and yada, yada, yada?
Compliance rules banking these days. Didn't used to. So we built compliance, all the regulatory frameworks, into Wells Bank's banking platform. So if you take this thing called a compliance manual, which is normally a lovely read, about an inch thick, and sits in your drawer, we've actually worked out a way to digitize that and make it active within all the onboarding a customer, with all the transactions of money going in and out. So everything complies with the regulation. That's what we've achieved with Wells
Bank. The UK regulation.
Regulation in each country.
Costa Rica.
We haven't done Costa Rica, but...
do Costa Rica. It's a very nice place, a friend of mine tells me.
Theoretically.
France, Germany, yes. America, Japan, so, Singapore.
And because of that, for the onboarding side, customer onboards, we have normalised what an onboarding pack is and collect the deltas, as you might say, the differences that are applicable to each country.
Which is, let's say, for the sake of argument, in Singapore they need to see my logo. In Japan they want to see a picture of my
ears,
face.
Yes, that type of thing. So that's the Wells Bank proposition. It's with the compliance piece, we call it compliance firewall, protects the banking platform. And the onboarding piece of that is we just onboard one, and then we work with all our partners to say, this is the normalised onboarding pack, sign off, boom, this guy's up and running. It just takes the headache away. And if you ask anybody, there's a certain well-known high street bank in the UK, open a business account, get shipped, so your KYC stuff gets shipped to several other countries. You're waiting for an answer for weeks when it should be a simple thing to do to open international banking.
That's clearly something that's properly digital, because you reduced it by orders of magnitude.
Yes, absolutely. Digital, if you look at the definition of digital, a quick rabbit hole here, is digital is all about removing friction. And that's where people like Monzo and others, they are digital because they're very, very good at that.
And reducing costs.
And reducing costs. And reducing friction costs. And so customer experience and journey is digital is about nothing really to do with technology, because you can be a digital first but have no technology there whatsoever by even answering the phone properly, if you see what I mean. So that's what we are. It's really about making transaction banking as frictionless and easy to use globally as possible.
And I think any kind of bankers listening or people who are just up in FS will know that what you have achieved is no trivial matter.
It's grey hair and needed some experience to be able to even attempt this, and it's a big project. Stripe did it for accepting payments online with cards. So we look at ourselves as Stripe for banking. We massively admire them as a company. And while they accept cards online with three lines of code, we are basically Access Global Banking.
You're going to get to 3 years, five.
Okay, so of the millions of listeners out there in many countries around the world, is it just UK people?
No.
That you're aiming for?
We're live in Europe at the moment. We're opening up in the US in H1 this year, so towards the end of Q2. What we'd like is companies who want to access or connect with their technology to a banking platform that is fast, it's global, can access a complete range of banking products with one API, can allow them to grow across borders. Please come talk to us. There's also banks in countries, we're looking at Southeast Asia at the moment. So I'm over in Southeast Asia in March, and I would love to see any banks who would like to be our banking partners or financial services partners in Singapore, Hong Kong, Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, and China, if anybody's there to join us. We're also hiring at the moment, and we need somebody who will be head of operations and customer to come join the team. And we're always looking for good biz dev people.
Excellent. Well, I think we've covered a huge tour d'horizon there, Nigel, and you must have Duracell batteries, other batteries are available, to keep you going and keep you creating all these things over the decade. So when I turn the microphones off, you can tell me your secret.
It's wine.
It's wine. Yes, fine wine, exactly fine. Well, that's how it bootstraps, you see, because the better the quality of the wine, the more creative you get. Well, thanks for that, Nigel, and I wish you every success in the future.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.